Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Don Cornegus, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Don. Great to be here.
So today we have the second part of our two-part interview with Dr. Jonathan Clark. He's a six-time space shuttle crew surgeon who has served in numerous critical roles for both NASA and the Navy. As I mentioned during the first part of our interview with John, he has become a very, very good friend and a colleague since I first met him here at IHMC.
Part one of our interview with John ended up with him talking about the space shuttle Columbia. In 2003, it disintegrated upon re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, killing all seven crew members, including John's wife, Laurel. Part two of our interview picks up with John talking about how he became a member of a NASA team that investigated every aspect of the Columbia disaster.
In today's episode, listeners also will learn about the extensive research that John's been doing on the neurologic effects of extreme environments, and also about the instrumental work that he's been doing in developing new protocols to benefit future aviators and astronauts. But before we get to part two of our interview with John, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful five-star reviews that are piling up on iTunes. As we announced in several earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews, with an eye towards selecting the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the nickname Donna Black Eye. There must be a story there. The review is simply titled Nina Teicholz and obviously refers to episode 52 of STEM Talk. The review reads, "Great podcast, incredibly important topic with compelling evidence for the importance of a high-fat and low-carbohydrate diet. Fascinating and frustrating expose on the pushback against established ideas, as well as the surprising role that personalities can play in scientific research."
Well, thank you, Donna Black Eye. And thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who have helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to part two of our interview with Dr. Jonathan Clark.
Dr. Jonathan Clark received his Bachelor of Science from Texas A&M University and medical degree from the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland. He is board certified in neurology and aerospace medicine. John devoted 26 years to active service with the U.S. Navy, during which he headed the Spatial Orientation Systems Department at the Naval Aerospace Medical Research Laboratory in Pensacola. He also held other top positions in the Navy and qualified as a Naval Flight Officer, Naval Flight Surgeon, Navy Diver, and Special Forces Freefall Parachutist.
John's service as a Space Shuttle Crew Surgeon was part of an 8-year tenure at NASA, where he was also Chief of the Medical Operations Branch and an FAA Senior Aviation Medical Examiner for the NASA Johnson Space Center Flight Medicine Clinic. He additionally served as a Department of Defense Space Shuttle Support Flight Surgeon covering two shuttle missions.
In addition to his new role as a senior research scientist at IHMC, John is an associate professor of neurology and space medicine at Baylor College of Medicine and teaches operations space medicine at Baylor Center for Space Medicine. He was also the space medicine advisor for the National Space Biomedical Research Institute and is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, where he teaches aerospace medicine residency.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
You were part of the NASA team, as you mentioned, that studied really every detail of the Columbia disaster. And when the team's report came out, you said, and I quote, "You have to find ways to turn badness into goodness. You have to. It's the only way you get through this." Can you talk about some of the lessons NASA learned?
Well, the beautiful thing about it is that NASA, they were very open to learning. Now, early on, we had talked about doing analyses that would find out what happened to the crew, and there was a little bit of reluctance to it. But the team itself knew that time will allow that to happen. And all the families, the Columbia families, were very ardently supportive of the fact that we would find out what would happen. Now, in most mishap investigations, there is always this sense of how did the crew perish? You know, did they contribute to it? Did they do the wrong procedure or somehow have a hand in that? And you might think, oh, you don't want to know that. And it's like, no, you do. You want to find out if there was something that was done that might have made it better or worse. That was important. So NASA funded the Columbia Survival Investigation Team. It was Wayne Hale, who was the head of mission operations, and Pam Elroy, who was an astronaut, who had basically put together this idea that we would study it, and it would be a systematic, would take as long as we needed to do that. And in the end, it's literally an amazing piece of work because it's a very thorough analysis. There were two books that came out of it. One was the book that came out in 2008, which was called the Columbia Survival Investigation Report. And then in 2014, the final report, which is called Loss of Signal, the Aeromedical Lessons of the Columbia Mishap. And that's the one that really gets into the weeds about how the crew perished, what happened, all the different things. And then point to the future. Here's what NASA was going to do is they're going to go from winged vehicles back to capsules because capsules, at least from a survival standpoint, have a lot more survival capabilities because they're all put together.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And they can support deep space missions where a vehicle with the wing would burn the wings right off at those reentry speeds.
Yeah. So there's quite a bit of, differences. What a winged vehicle does is it allows you to touch down on a runway, with a couple of feet per second landing speed. So it's a much softer landing, but it does that at an incredible inefficiency, the volumetric efficiency. The vehicle itself is 2 or 3 times bigger than it needs to be. And that means that you have to carry that extra weight, which doesn't necessarily give you, a useful space, if you think about it. So it gave them pause and reflection, and they said, hey, we're going to deep space, we're going to go there, and the capsule's the way to go. It has options throughout the entire phase of flight, including an abort off the pad, which Columbia or any of the space shuttles did not have. They couldn't abort off the pad with an escape system. And the other thing is that it just does lend itself to the deep space side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of moving forward a little bit. So on October 14th, 2012, 65 years to the day after Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in the X-1, you were part of a team that successfully accomplished the highest stratospheric freefall parachute jump from 128,100 feet. So how did you first become involved with this record-breaking jump?
Again, it's this synergy in life. So having done the analysis of in the Columbia Survival Investigation Report, I look back at all the historical events, including high-altitude balloons, SR-71s that flew at Mach 3. The amazing thing is that we took all of those lessons, even though they didn't necessarily seem like they might relate to space, and kind of point to what do we learn from that. So in 2009, there was a team that was forming that asked me to be a part of it. Actually, the guy that was on the team was a real close friend of mine, Jim Bajan. Mm-hmm. He had been involved in both the Challenger and Columbia mishaps.
Wow.
And he's a flight surgeon, parachutist, astronaut, a great guy. And he was the original guy that was on this group that was doing just basically the concept development part. And Jim goes, I need to bring the guy that really knows this stuff, John, on because of the bailout part of it. I'm more in the weeds tactical, whereas he was the more strategic side of things. And so I joined the team, and there were obviously multiple components of it. So there was the group that was the launch, how do we get to the, up there? You can do a balloon or a rocket. You had the capsule part. You had the spacesuit part, the parachute descent part. And my part was the soft, squishy hardware, which is the human, the one that doesn't always fit right and has all these other challenges.
And often acts up and yeah.
So that was my team. And I say my team, but really they were the team that did it. And all I was a part of their efforts.
So what did your support team look like for the jump?
Well, it was physicians, physiologists. We also had backup with the Red Bull Human Performance Group. Red Bull was the funding sponsor, and the jumper was an Austrian parachutist named Felix Baumgartner, who'd done some flight tests. He'd flown across the English Channel on a wing without propulsion. And he does base jumps, which basically jump off of, you know, structures close to ground. Mm-hmm. And you talk about that's riskier than what we were doing. Mm-hmm. So what I had to do was to pull together the group that would look at all the risks that we faced and attack those risks with a tiered defense. You know, it's defense in depth, layers of defense. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we got to do. And the other interesting thing about it was, you know, obviously money is always a factor. Doesn't matter what you're doing, whether it's government funding or private funding or industry, they all have money. So the initial thing was, well, they had enough money for a few people. And I said, you know, that's not going to work. I said, I need a lot of people. So here's what we're going to do. You're going to not pay us, and you're going to pay for the costs, and I will bring in whoever I need to get this done.
Wow.
Half of my team was made up of residents and med students.
Perfect.
and every one of them got to be first author on an article. And this has been, you know, you talk about mentorship. This is like, you're going to do this area. You know, pick an area, or I'll give you an area that you go become the expert in.
That's fantastic.
It was a wonderful team. And we're still very close.
What kind of preparation did you and the rest of the team have to go through for the jump? And how long was the preparatory period? Several years?
Well, the preparatory period, so the hardware started getting built in 2009. And, you know, it was about 5 years from 2009 to 2012, give or take a period of time. Hardware was being built. Testing was done. Refinements were being made. It was a flight test program, and it was run like a flight test program with different components being tested in, you know, environments that were not as dangerous. So you want to test in free fall in a pressure suit, put them in a vertical wind tunnel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the worst thing that happened is they bang up the suit, you know. So after we got the vertical wind tunnel testing done, then we do jumps from helicopters and then low altitude and then high altitude. High altitude being 26 to 7,000 feet. Then the next thing is you got to go higher, you go up in a balloon. Now, before we did that, we tested all of our equipment in vacuum chambers and thermal vacuum. Thermal vacuum allows you to test in cold environments and also in low pressure environments. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you can see where things fail. And then you go and start doing incremental flight tests. You start out low and you work your way up. And every test we did, we learned from it. We spent a lot of time dissecting and analyzing it, and then we're ready for the next jump.
And so what were the major medical concerns for the jump?
The concerns are pretty much the same as we face in space flight. So you have the launch issues. So in our case, that we had a launch from a balloon. Mm-hmm. A balloon goes up at about 1,000 feet per minute. That's pretty slow. And the problem is there's a window. The most dangerous time was not the balloon at a high altitude. It's the balloon at low altitude with a rupture.
Okay.
And then you're in a situation where you don't have enough time to get out of the capsule and open your parachute. Even though he's a base jumper, and he jumped from, I think, Christ the Redeemer statue was maybe 50 feet off the ground. So, you know, he's used to low altitude jumps.
Yeah.
It's just not low altitude in a suit where you have to get the hatch open.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the launch early ascent phase concerns. And then once you get up to the high altitudes, now you're in stratosphere. The stratosphere is above the weather part of the atmosphere, which is the troposphere. And so above 45, 50,000 feet, you're now in what's called the stratosphere. It's wicked cold, minus 70 degrees.
Wow.
It's, you know, when you're at 100,000 feet, it's 1% of the atmospheric pressure that you would have at sea level. So these low temperatures, low atmospheric pressure, all those kinds of things now become the major driver. What we did is we broke them down into those risks. And then there's the landing risk. So every time you take off and land, those are risks. But the risks that were unique to this specific operation were low atmospheric pressure, the vacuum of space. And then the other thing is if you're in free fall, you don't have aerodynamic control. And so you have acceleration forces, specifically the flat spin. Now, those are similar things that you have to encounter in aircraft that fly above 50,000 feet, like mm-hmm. the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird. So those were risks that we faced. There were two Blackbird breakups in 1966 that we learned from, how the crew survived or didn't, And then there were four people attempted to jump from the stratosphere, okay, like we were doing. There was an Air Force group and a civilian group, and there was a Russian Air Force team that did it too. And of those four people that had tried in the 60s, from 1960 to 1966, two of the four died. And that had a psychological impact for sure. Actually, that was probably one of the most challenging parts of it, was the psychology of facing, you know, death,
mm-hmm,
and having so many systems that you were dependent on that could fail in very complex and unanticipated ways. It's not like a base jump where by the time you realize that the parachute didn't open, you're already dead.
Right.
You know, you're going faster than you can perceive it. But when you're going to 128,000 feet and you're falling, you know, even supersonically, you have a long time to think about the terminal point. The cool thing is, so we did this jump, we didn't plan on it being the 65th anniversary of Chuck Yeager's flight.
Oh, you didn't?
No, it was just all pure, you know, pure luck.
Coincidence, that's cool.
And the cool thing is, Chuck Yeager, he broke the speed of sound. He got to 1.06 Mach. So that's not supersonic, that's transonic. Mm-hmm. You don't get supersonic till you go Mach 1.2.
Mm-hmm.
We did that.
Very cool.
Without an airplane. And then 2 years and 10 days later, we did it again with a different team, a different pressure suit. So when people were saying, oh, it's a stunt, it's like, not really. We did two different jump team projects. And the first one took 5 years. The second one took 2 years and they were doing jumps 2 weeks apart.
Mm.
So that's the beauty of it, is we really took those lessons from the Rebel Stratus and put it into the next one, which was the Google executive Alan Eustace and Stratic Space Dive. It was an unbelievable team, an unbelievable effort. And the medical team was continuous throughout both of those.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, too, when you're talking about the medical team, we talk a lot about continuous physiological monitoring in the research world and also when it comes to different types of applications in the operational setting. So what kind of monitoring were you doing before, during, and after the jump?
Well, I'd like to say we had everything worked out, and the physiologic monitoring, if you look at it in a holistic way, is when we fly vehicles or we operate vehicles, whether it's a car or an aircraft or a submersible, you want to have parameters that are telling you what the vehicle is doing. How deep are you? What's your fuel range? What's your endurance? What's my rate limiting consumable?
Mm-hmm.
You want to have insight into the vehicle status. The human is another black box, a squishy, soft black box, and we need the same insight into that black box. Now, in monitoring people in extreme environments, the same thing applies. I think this is the goal that we have in this approach to physiologic monitoring, and it's not just extreme environments. It could be point-of-care home health care.
Mm-hmm.
It could be on a road trip, you know, when driving a car. How am I doing? Where am I on my performance envelope? Am I in a yellow zone or a red zone? Is my, you know, just like we have car engine RPM and speed and fuel gauge, we want to know what's in our fuel gauge. So we were monitoring things, but it was very rudimentary. It was heart rate. And when we got back and were able to look at it, we had a much greater insight. But the real world insight was only when we had telemetry access in the capsule. And once he was out, all we had was his voice comm and what we could see from the ground. Ideally, for future endeavors, be they going to Everest or deep dives or rescues, cave rescues or whatever, again, we want to have insight into those. And fortunately, we're doing that kind of project now here, you know, at IHMC and also in other places, where we're trying to figure out what's the human endurance profile, what's mm-hmm. its gas gauge doing.
Yep.
And if once the gas is empty, how long does it take to refill it again so he can do it again, or he or she can do it again?
That's a great way of putting that, by the way.
Well, you know, when I was working in aviation, I always tried to put pilot stuff in terms of aircraft stuff
mm-hmm.
because people understood that. You know, you come back now on an aircraft and you can download the chip and you can get every parameter. Was the airframe overstressed? Do we need to put it in for a maintenance cycle? Do we need to do non-destructive inspections? Things like that. And the same thing applies to the humans. We are pushing the human now in an envelope, in a threat area, that far exceeds, in some cases, their capability or may have long-term health consequences. So when you talk to people who work with systems like aircraft, they get that and they go, oh, yeah, how can we not have insight? Now, that's the goal. Yeah. We want to have insight into the human side of things, just like we do for our vehicles.
And that's a perfect transition to kind of talking about some of your research efforts that you've been involved with NASA to deal with the neurologic effects of extreme environments on crews. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the nature of these neurological issues, specifically when it comes to space exposure?
Well, we've had, I think it's about 550 people have flown in orbit, space being defined as over 100 kilometers or 62 miles or 328,000 feet. That's in 50 plus years since Yuri Gagarin flew in April of 61. So we don't have a huge amount of numbers in that environment. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do is we have to learn everything we can from the ones that have been there and then in analog environments. So recently, NASA, who's been flying on the space station since the late 90s, and in fact, it was wonderful to hear Bill Shepard's talks as the first ISS commander when it was just a little, it was a module and a half size, and it was a teeny little thing. And now it's this, you know, football field sized vehicle that can accommodate, you know, 6-7 crew at a time.
Yeah.
So we're really building up the numbers and we're building up the durations and longer flights. Scott Kelly and his cosmonaut colleague have done a, you know, 11-month, and they're planning on 5 more one-year missions for NASA to look at this. But in 2005, the first case was identified in a long-duration astronaut of what had become to be known as the visual impairment intracranial pressure syndrome. As a doctor, you can look in the fundus of the eye, the back of the eye, and you can see where the optic nerve comes into the retina. So the optic nerve is the wire bundle, and the retina is the photocell sensors. So just like in a camera, you've got sensors and you've got a system that transmits those signals. And when you see where the optic nerve goes into the back of the eye, it shows what's called optic nerve head swelling or papilledema. Mm-hmm. And you can see that from a tumor in the brain, or you can see it with increased pressure that sometimes women get without a tumor. And that was first appreciated in 2005. Since that time, there's been 64 astronauts who've been systematically studied, and 24 of them have had findings that have been suggestive of, but not proven to be, higher increased pressure in the brain. Mm-hmm. So we don't really know what's going on there, but we know that it's something that we need to pay more attention to. So now the syndrome is called the spaceflight-associated neuroocular syndrome, mm-hmm. not the visual impairment intracranial pressure syndrome. And it is one of the top priorities for NASA and all human spaceflight endeavors to better understand this. Why is that? Because if it happens in crew members who've flown 6 months in low Earth orbit, then it's going to definitely be an issue for a Mars mission or a cislunar mission where you're flying in deep space, where you now have the component of radiation not protected by the Earth's electromagnetic field.
Right.
And you've got much longer periods. These periods could be 700, 800, 1,000 days, as opposed to, you know, the standard 180-day missions.
Intermittent artificial gravity has been discussed over the years many times as a way to potentially mitigate some of the medical risk factors associated with long-duration space missions. Can you talk about how that might be accomplished in space and what we know about the effects of intermittent gravity?
Humans are an incredibly adaptive species. Like many of the species on Earth, they have to adapt to survive to changes in their environments. And so you see species that have adapted to extreme low pressures in higher altitudes, humans as well as animals. You see species that have adapted to altered pressures and also altered temperatures. I love seeing the deep sea exploration, looking at those sulfur vents in the mid-ocean ridges, and their clams and spider crabs and animals are surviving, you know, incredibly, you know, thousands of atmospheres of pressure and extreme, cold temperatures in a place that we would never consider would even be, have life there.
Mm-hmm.
Laurel's quote from the space shuttle mission was that life is a magical thing. And I love that quote because it is. It is magic that we and other creatures can survive in all these unusual environments. So the one variable that we have never been without is gravity.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one variable that we probably have the least experience in adapting to, except in space, you know, exploration on space stations for long periods of time. One thing we know is that gravity is something we're used to. We can adapt to it. We've had crew that have lived 14 months without gravity, the one cosmonaut, Valery Polyakov. And we've had other crews that have, you know, I think the record's in over 800 days now, cumulative time in space. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can thrive there. We can survive, but we can't thrive. And if we're going to go from a smaller expedition to an outpost would be something like the Antarctic experience, where you have people that are there in larger numbers, several hundreds or so, to colonies where you're bringing everybody, artists, bakers, construction workers, families, and raising children. Now that's going to change the game big time. What we do know from the animal studies is that in the early developmental phase without gravity, that organisms, say a tadpole, become incredibly dysmorphic. They have structural abnormalities that are really substantial. Instead of being a like pointy like a tadpole is, mm-hmm. they become a comma, they become a curlicue. Their spine ends up rotating around on their back. Well, interesting thing is, if you can get them during that phase where they've gotten that dysmorphic configuration, that spinal curvature, and you put gravity back in, they straighten out. But if they go for longer periods of time, they end up dying. Mm-hmm. They can't survive without gravity. So we know if we're going to have colonies and we're going to have children and we're going to raise kids through the developmental phase, learn something along the way that we're going to need some form of gravity. The question is how much?
Mm-hmm.
And gravity, you know, is the force of gravity is, you know, 9.8 meters per second squared on Earth. Do you need that constantly, or can you have a percentage of that, or can you do it intermittently?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the big question now. And artificial gravity is still a hot topic, but there's a huge amount of engineering and operational challenges with gravity. Part of the reason is that it requires a vehicle to move.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say, well, let's try a tether, you know, where you tie two spacecraft together and then you rotate them. Well, we've done a couple of tethered missions, even as far back as Gemini. And the tethers can end up, first of all, in low Earth orbit, they can create electromagnetic forces that we have to contend with. Static electricity buildup, et cetera. And they can also have structural problems that they break. And so tethers are a cool idea, but they still have a lot to be worked out. Part of it is that they may oscillate, you know. Mm-hmm. And when they oscillate or flutter, like in aerodynamics, flutter is a bad thing. And oscillations, you know, like if you think about a long wire, you know, that's got a cycle to it, that can be structurally very damaging. So the point is, we have a lot of challenges with artificial gravity. The current ones that are being looked at more closely now are what we call short-arm centrifuges.
Right.
And those are smaller, that can fit into small pressurized volumes that we currently have size for. The problem is, to get a G-force that we think is useful, it's probably going to be at least a third of a G, that you now have to spin at higher rates. And the higher rate of spin, it's not just linear part, it's the angular part. And the angular part is what makes you more prone to motion sickness.
Mm.
So it's one thing to be on a centrifuge that's, you know, several hundred meters long and having a spin rate that's less than 6 RPM. But if you have over 6 RPM, you can have some component of motion sickness or vestibular disturbance. Some of the centrifuges that are really have done some instrumental work I was involved with when I was at NASA, where we had a crew on there for 24 hours.
Okay.
Untethered. So they're walking around inside their cabin, you know, without any tethers. So there's some great facilities, but, you know, the problem is they cost money to keep them going. So I hope artificial gravity gets a big plus up in research, because it's a really, to me, it's a crucial area.
You see designs for human-powered centrifuges, so you combine exercise and gravity.
Actually, there's one of those at Ames,
right?
And that's a perfect scenario because one is you're using the human to power at which he needs exercise, and he can modulate it. If he's feeling queasy or he's going too fast or he's feeling lightheaded, he can back off. Mm-hmm. So I really like that idea.
I recall Joan Vernikos talking about that.
She did.
That's right, right.
And earlier STEM talk.
You know, there's this connectedness. All the STEM talks have some connection, you know, one degree of freedom away.
I wonder if that has anything to do with a double secret selection committee.
All votes are unanimous.
So we're going to move over just for a second. So NASA recently released a report describing an increased incidence of white matter hyperintensities in astronauts. Why are we seeing these lesions now and not in earlier crew? Or what do you think?
Well, let me start from the basics. So we have now advanced imaging capabilities that allow us to see and get insight into the brain's structure and function to degrees we never could have imagined several decades ago. So the new thing now with the magnetic resonance imaging technology is opening up huge new frontiers of discovery. White matter hyperintensities are something that is seen with that advanced imaging capability. Mm-hmm. In a simplistic way, in the brain, we have the neurons, which are, say, like the processors, and the wires, which are the axons. So you have centers that do computations, and then you transfer that information through the wire bundles. White matter hyperintensities are imaging techniques that have detected something that's not what is considered normal. Mm-hmm. And white matter is the wire bundle, the axons. Specifically, the white matter is the myelin around the axon. So when we're talking about these things, what they are is there's something that's affecting the wire bundles. Myelin has a lot of fat in it. So there's a question about, was it related to something in the fat of our brain? You know, when somebody says you're a fathead, that's a compliment.
I'll remember that.
The interesting thing is these white matter hyperintensities have been studied now in a more systematic way because of the capabilities that the imaging technologies allowed. But what we're starting to see is if you take a study and you compare it to some other group, the worrisome thing is that we're seeing these white matter hyperintensities in brains of astronauts younger than they would see in other conditions. But it's seen in a lot of different things. It's seen in as you age, there's a higher incidence. It's seen after trauma. It's seen in Alzheimer's. It's seen in metabolic conditions like diabetes and heart disease and vascular disease. Mm-hmm. So there's no specific, if you see white matter hyperintensities, it means this. No, we don't know. It's perhaps a warning sign that something's going on, but we need to look at it more closely. What is interesting and perhaps scary is that it's seen in extreme environment exposures, whether it be high altitude mountain climbers, divers in high pressure environments, pilots flying in the stratosphere, like in specifically the U-2 aircraft that flies, you know, in the 70,000 foot range, mm-hmm. and now in astronauts. And the astronauts have shown it, and it's not related to exposure during spacewalks where you do get a pressure reduction. So this is a big unknown right now that's being very, very aggressively studied at NASA and other space agencies around the world, trying to figure out what does this mean? So to me, it's an unknown. It's a harbinger of something that could be potentially problematic, but we really don't have an idea of why they're there.
So yeah, John, that's a great point. And also the DoD communities are really interested in this as well because of some of those populations that you were talking about that seemed susceptible to increased levels of these white matter hyperintensities. And for our listeners, John and I are actually on a NASA Translational Research Institute project that's looking at the effect of simulated microgravity on brain lymphatic outflow. And we think that there may be some kind of tie there between impaired brain lymphatic outflow and development of these white matter hyperintensities. John, I'm going to let you talk a little bit more about this study for our listeners since you're our guest.
Well, this is one of those areas that's super cutting edge research. And if you look up brain lymphatics, or glial lymphatics, are also called glymphatics. It's a very hot topic now in head trauma and in Alzheimer's and a number of conditions that affect the nervous system, and potentially has implications for virtually everybody who lives, you know, a good, healthy, long life. So this project that Don is the principal investigator on is to look at new imaging technologies, specifically about the flow of the lymph system. Now, the lymph system is probably a less understood than most other systems. Like, we have our arteries that pump the blood in a high pressure capacity, and we have the capillaries that distribute the nutrients and oxygen to the tissues. And we have the venous system, which is the low pressure system. But there's this real low pressure filter system called the lymph system. And the problem is, it's very hard to study because, you know, in people that are dead, the lymph system collapses and you don't even see it. So this system that Don is now working on has this ability to see lymph in humans, in real people, using a fluorescent marker and night vision goggle image intensifier tubes. And when you see it, it's absolutely magical. It pulsates, and it's a slower moving system. It's like, I would, my analogy to it would be, it's like the Florida Everglades versus the Mississippi River.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting that.
And because of its extremely slow nature, we don't see it, just like we don't see glaciers. Glaciers are rivers of ice that are moving, and you don't see them unless you look at them over time lapse. So I think part of it, what we need to do is to start changing our spatial temporal resolution on things and start looking at things in slower motion and see these flows, like the flow through the Everglades, which most people don't realize it actually flows.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about what happens in the Everglades as an analogy, I think part of it is that, you know, there's pollutants, you know, whether it's farm runoff or, you know, a spill in the water, and it may take decades for it to get flushed out. So something similar is going on in the brain. The brain is an active, very active metabolic organ. It's 2% of the body weight and 25% of the metabolic rate. So it uses way more energy than you would account for by its size. In the process of it's that high metabolic rate, what happens? You know, whether you're driving a car or a lawnmower or whatever, you burn fuel and it creates a waste product, a gas. Something is going on in this process. Metabolic activity is ongoing, and then those waste products have to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
If they aren't effectively removed, they build up toxic substances that are also what are suspected to be a problem in dementia,
mm-hmm.
You know, the beta amyloid plaques, and also that similar kind of toxic products after head trauma. So something happens in the process of trauma, and then the body says, hey, I got to repair itself. It tries to flush out all the reparative waste products, and something impedes that.
Mm.
So this is super cutting edge, and I'm looking forward to hearing your talk on this in a couple of years, because I'm fascinated by it, and I'm just, you know, really blessed to be a part of the team to look at this.
Yeah, it's a really exciting study. And just as a side note, our collaborator, Dr. Eva Sivic, is the person who came up with the technology that we're using to visualize both the peripheral lymphatic system and also drainage from the brain into the cervical lymphatics. So we will be keeping our listeners up to date on what we're doing there in that space. So that was a great description, John. I'm going to go high level here. So trying to perform effective aeromedical research with either aviators or astronauts can sometimes be difficult due to a fear of participating in studies whose findings might actually affect an aviator's or astronaut's flight status. And the same goes for many fields across the military and athletic communities. Can you talk about how you address these concerns and kind of gain the trust and also set up a system where you can do these studies effectively without that concern built in?
Well, this is probably one of the biggest challenges we face in any endeavor is, when we measure something, it may have implications on somebody's career. The way I look at this is again, you kind of take back that analogy to the car. You know, if you're going to drive a car, fly an airplane, or even ride a bike, you want to know that it's in good physical order. So the way I approach it in trying to recruit test subjects is to say, by our advancing knowledge, we will have better insight into your performance. More importantly, it's the long-term aspects of it. So even though the research may not help you, it might help your son or daughter when he or she goes and does these incredible things. Mm-hmm. Even before the subjects are even allowed to be screened, I would always go on the device or the test so that I would have an understanding of it. And some of my, you know, people that I've been most proud to be associated with were like, say, John Paul Stapp. You know, a test subject never wrote it before he had done it first. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we would say is that we all are research participants here. And the thing is, we have to always be mindful of it, the beneficial effects for the person themselves, and the importance that the science that they help support goes to the future.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
You've been extensively involved in previous investigations focused on physiological episodes in the aviation community, and this is unfortunately a growing concern. Can you talk more about what is meant by the term physiological episode and give us a few examples?
Well, I mean, the hot area right now in the military, and the term they use now as physiologic episode, it relates to the introduction of a new technology into aircraft for life support. And the system I'm referring to is the onboard oxygen generating systems, or OBOGs, which use a molecular sieve. If you think about the molecules of oxygen have a different molecular weight than the molecules of nitrogen. And because of the difference in size, as small as it may be, you can actually create a sieve that allows, you know, one to be concentrated on one side with the application of energy. So when these systems were used or implemented in aircraft, they replaced a system that was far more dangerous and cumbersome, which was oxygen tanks or liquid oxygen canisters. And if you think about it, an aircraft that can fly and generate its own oxygen just with the power of the aircraft has got a huge advantage because it doesn't have to come back and be serviced or refueled. And liquid oxygen, you know, when we were going through, that was the modality that our aircraft used. And they would take a little drop of liquid oxygen and they would drop it on a piece of, like a little spot of fuel on the tarmac, and it would blow up. So it was meant to show you how dangerous liquid oxygen is, besides the fact that it's minus 270 degrees or something. And if it touched you, it would, you know, instantly freeze. Mm-hmm. It was also very difficult to handle and to use, but you need oxygen. So the idea that you would develop a system that would generate its own oxygen is awesome. The downside is that it's a very complex system. It has to have various ways to push gas through and off-gas the gases that are not necessary. And in the process, these systems, these very complex systems, it hasn't fully been understood how they actually do what they're supposed to do and do it reliably and effectively all the time. So what's happened, and I was just going through my notes the other day about this. I was involved in the early analysis of it. In 2009, it was noticed to be a problem in the F-22, which is our absolute frontline air combat fighter, the F-22 Raptor. Since then, it's now spread to other airframes, such as the F-18, which is a top-line Navy Marine fighter bomber, and also in training aircraft like the T-45, which So systems, it no longer is just something in one aircraft. It's in multiple aircraft, but the common theme seems to be this onboard oxygen generating system. Early on, the symptoms that were identified by pilots were felt to be due to hypoxia. So they had originally called it hypoxia-like episodes. Now they don't know that it's hypoxia. It could be increased ventilation. It could be another environmental contaminant or whatever, and it is now called a physiologic episode. So that's meant to be a non-judgmental description as opposed to something that says, oh, it's just hypoxia. So the fact that these episodes have become evident in both the Air Force and the Navy Marine aircraft and other countries' aircraft who fly similar aircraft, that we've got to put our heads together and see what's going on. And actually, some of the cutting-edge work is being done right here in Pensacola to try to ascertain that. One is by studying the systems themselves and then studying how the human interfaces with it.
Yeah.
So it, to me, this is another one of those areas that, you know, is going to be expanded on and further delineated. And right now, all we know is that there's something going on there. And it may be that by understanding how physiologically we interact with these complex systems, we'll be able to better implement devices as they come online. To me, this is an ideal example of why we have human life science research mm-hmm. is because you can never fully understand the full grasp of the interactive effects of complex machines and how the human interacts with it.
Yep.
And that's really what IHMC is all about, at some level, the interaction of humans with complicated machines.
Yep, absolutely.
In fact, Jeff Phillips is working on this problem, I think.
Yeah, Jeff and John have been on a lot of the calls and have been and will be heavily involved in this research. So pretty exciting as we move forward. So John, I'm kind of talking about all these different areas of research. What do you see as some of the most exciting areas of research for extreme environmental medicine and human performance?
Well, to me, Laurel used to say life is a magical thing. And I think the fact that we see humans that were continuing to push the frontiers of human survival, and really it's not just to survive, but to thrive, is part of what we're trying to do. It's not just about being able to go there and, you know, stay for a short time, but it's to be able to go there and function in a fully integrated fashion.
Mm-hmm.
In you know, if you think about diving, you know, we dive down, look at something, and now we can do saturation diving and go down and stay for long periods of time. So I think for me, what a big part of it is to have a much greater understanding of what the human actually does in its adaptive response to the environment. And how do we do that? We do it with various kinds of monitoring systems that we're working on, physiologic monitoring systems, anatomic imaging monitoring systems, biomarkers that are the biochemical signals that say, hey, this is what's going on. Because I think, too, humans are adaptive, and a lot of the conditions that plague us in modern society are actually maladaptive responses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I look at the, you know, migraine was one of those conditions that a neurologist see a lot of. And I always thought, you know, because we see more migraine now, it's a maladaptiveness. The human was very attuned to smells or ingested things. And nowadays, they have reactions to them that might be manifested by headaches. The sickle cell is a maladaptive condition. If you were trying to survive in a malaria-prone region, you develop this protective effect. And so what was adaptive in sub-Central Africa is maladaptive in another state. So I guess the take-home point I'm trying to make here is that as we learn how humans adapt, survive, and eventually thrive in one extreme, we have to understand the downside, which is the maladaptiveness. And the only way we're going to get a handle on that is to have better insight into these basic things, whether they are biochemical or physiological or anatomical.
You were instrumental in having EEG recordings removed from the standard flight physical. Can you tell us what led to your concerns on this measurement and why you think EEGs are not germane to standard flight physicals?
Well, I mean, EEG is just, you know, electroencephalogram is the way of, it's measuring millivolt amplitudes over the head. When I was in flight school, and there are probably some listeners in the audience who were, you know, in flight school in the 70s, but when I was in flight school, they did EEGs because they thought it might tell if you had seizure potential and then it would throw you out. And so when I went through, they would line up 20 beds and the EEG tech would come and he would stick needle electrodes in each subject and then he would plug in the wires into the EEG, do a recording for a certain period of time, and then move down the hall or move down the row of 20 gurneys. And at the very end, he would come and grab each bundle and pull it off your head. And there was these, everybody's walked out with these, you know, little pinprick holes in your head as the rite of passage. And I thought, man, there's got to be a better way. And I've actually written articles on EEG. Even though EEG has got some utility and they're actually using it in some of the physiologic episode analysis, what we have to realize is that when you do a test to select somebody for flight training or high-risk activities or performance, where performance matters, you've got to have a really well-refined set of tests. And what I had done in the analysis of EEGs was to actually show that for every person that you might keep from flying who might have a seizure, you'd throw out 40 or 50 good people. And we need good people. And so the test, if we're going to use them in selection, be it for air crew or submarines or high altitude, you know, mountaineering or whatever, is that they have to have a very high predictive value and not throw out 40 good people to find the one that might have a problem. So even though I love technology, I also think that technology needs to be very, very appropriately used. And if we're going to make a decision, yeah, you're going to go into this training program or not, it better be the best decision that it could possibly be.
Yeah, that makes
so,
sense.
So, you know, that's just my little soapbox on that.
So, John, you've also done a fair bit of research and application with hyperbaric oxygen or breathing high-pressure oxygen. So right now we are seeing a bit of push to bring hyperbaric oxygen therapy in as a treatment for things like traumatic brain injury and PTSD. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, early in my military medical career, I was involved at the Navy's hyperbaric program in Bethesda, the Navy Medical Research Institute. And we were doing saturation diving. We were looking at all the different aspects of how do humans survive and do work at these deep depths. My boss at the time was a famous neurologist and hyperbaric medicine guy, John Hollenbeck, and his big area of interest was stroke. Mm-hmm. And so there was this idea that, well, you know, if stroke is a lack of blood flow or ischemia to a certain regions of the brain, and, you know, maybe by giving oxygen, hyperbaric oxygen, you can avoid, you know, you can overcome that. And some of the early studies would show that there would be a benefit, but it would only be during that period of high oxygen exposure. So hyperbaric oxygen is well known to treat bubble diseases, mm-hmm. like decompression sickness, which is nitrogen bubbles, or arterial gas embolism, which is bubbles that come into the bloodstream from a pressure overinflation in the lungs, say rapid ascending from the bottom. Sometimes it's seen in surgical procedures where you're operating on somebody in the sitting position and you cut into a vein and all this air goes into the open vascular system. So hyperbaric oxygen has very clear indications for some bubble diseases and also for other conditions as well. I think there are 14, you know, accepted uses now for wound healing is another one. Mm-hmm. That's not a bubble-related disease, but clearly is helpful. So what we have to do is we have to say, okay, if we're going to use hyperbaric oxygen because it is a drug, it needs to be done, you know, based on evidence, not on just, hey, I think it's a good procedure, and especially when I'm getting paid to do a procedure. So a big part of anything, and now with hyperbaric oxygen, is using it in an appropriate, proven way. Mm-hmm. That's what science is all about. It's about helping establish the evidence to support that. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about this, and I've actually, you know, recently looked at this, and I've been astonished, is that we've now seen in multiple centers and studies after injuries to the brain, specifically military injuries that are related to BLAST, which is an overpressure syndrome, is that hyperbaric oxygen administered even years after the injury can have some beneficial effects. What's going on there? Mm-hmm. Again, this is an area that needs to be really looked at because the studies have shown, at least the analysis is that it does seem to have a beneficial effect, and it's more lasting than just the therapy itself is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that we will have some follow-on, you know, areas of research. Why is this important? Well, the football-associated chronic traumatic encephalopathy is getting to be a very, very public concern. I mean, Aaron Hernandez died. He was the youngest case died. He had some outbursts and was charged with murder. And you wonder, gosh, was that related to the repeated head blows
mm-hmm.
in his brain? You know, certainly the National Football League is concerned about this, but we see head trauma in kids playing soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And now the concern is, wow, is there something that, you know, we may be setting kids up for long-term consequences?
Mm-hmm.
And in the military, we see blast injuries from improvised explosive devices, from, you know, firing shoulder-fired tank and anti-personnel rockets, things like that create these transient blast effects.
Mm-hmm.
Breaching is a source of a lot of blast injury.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and, you know, breaching, you know, you have to, you know, the police have to do it in a, you know, a SWAT scenario or a hostage rescue that the military does. So I'm thinking that there are a lot of modalities out there, but to me, the one that needs to be aggressively studied and at the highest level is this hyperbaric oxygen therapy, because, you know, it certainly seems like it's very promising.
It just needs to be done in a very systematic and you know, stringent fashion. So, and you and I have talked a fair bit about that. Just switching over for a second, you've been extensively involved in suit testing for NASA and other commercial entities. What does this testing involve? It sounds like it's a lot of fun. And what will our future spacesuits look like, at least as of now?
Oh, wow. Well, I have been involved in suit testing, and it's mostly because we were using suits as a means to create a survivable atmosphere. If you're in a vacuum of space, and let me just kind of describe how that goes. It's too bad I can't show you the video, but if you go above 63,000 feet, approximately the altitude, you exceed the vapor pressure of water. Now, that's in, you know, everybody who ever's done the pulmonary gas equation knows that vapor pressure water, it's 47 millimeters of mercury.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that if you go to a pressure that's lower than 47 millimeters of mercury, water in its liquid state spontaneously effervesces and goes to a gaseous state. I've got an unbelievably cool video that shows that when you go to these higher altitudes, lower pressures, water, it not only bubbles, it freezes. It's the triple point.
Hmm.
And so there's a point where water, this magical dihydrogen oxide, is this marvelous material that we need for life. And it has this unique property where it can bubble and freeze at the same time. So when you go to space above 63,000 feet, or you go to the stratosphere like we did in these high-altitude jump projects, the water, which 70% of our body is composed of, can spontaneously boil.
Yeah.
Now, every time we did a vacuum chamber run, we would put a flask of water in there just to show you this is what's going to happen to you if that suit loses its integrity. It can come off from a glove seal. It can come off if the visor pops off. A lot of different things. And we actually developed a treatment protocol that if we got them back down on the ground fast enough, we could completely override the negative effects and keep them alive and they would recover. And there have been actually humans that have survived for 2.5-3 minutes of exposure to vacuum.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's killed crew, too. It killed the Soyuz 11 crew. It killed the Columbia crew. They mm-hmm. died of ebullism. That's the technical term for water vapor going from a liquid to a gas.
Mm-hmm.
So suits, the first and foremost thing that a spacesuit does or a pressure suit does is it keeps you from dying of exposure to vacuum, which is the water. Your water boils. We have to have pressure and oxygen to survive. That's the thing that, you know, if you don't have it, you know, in a couple of minutes, you're going to be unconscious, and very shortly thereafter, you'll eventually, you know, cause enough damage that your brain won't recover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So suit testing is done in a vacuum chamber, and I was involved in the Red Bull Stratus suit tests in a vacuum chamber, and also the suit test for the Stratix suit, which was an, so David Clark made the Red Bull suit. ILC Dover made the suit that was used in the Stratic space dive Google jump. And then I was also involved in a commercial space company suit that mm-hmm. is one of the NASA suit providers. SpaceX did their suit test too. And so what we're there for is to basically, if they lose suit pressure, we're there to respond in an emergency fashion. I love looking at old pressure suits. And I've done a talk on them. Wiley Post flew to the Winnie Mae, which was his flight to 50,000 feet. And he wore a suit that was a diving suit mm-hmm. that was configured to provide pressure. And you know what they used was a liquid oxygen converter. And this was in, I think, 35.
Wow.
Can you imagine that? I mean, back then they had incredible insight and technology.
Just the evolution. We should get him to do a talk just on the evolution of suits. That'd be really cool.
Yeah. We had a meeting here at IHMC maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago during the Constellation program when NASA was planning a return to the moon. Mm-hmm. Where they brought each of the generations of NASA spacesuits and also a former Soviet spacesuit. So the meeting's presentations were fascinating, but it was also very interesting looking at the evolution of the suits themselves.
Right.
So my good friend and colleague David Newman is a big proponent of a new form of suit, which was tested in the 60s. And it's the suits that are used now have a pressured atmosphere, where the new suit based on the old suit is called a mechanical counterpressure suit. Mm-hmm. And that's basically a tight suit, very conformal, very fashionably flattering as opposed to the current pressure suits. Now, the suits were originally built and designed and tested by a guy named Paul Webb. And he actually used one in a vacuum chamber in the 60s and showed how easy you could get around with it. And Davis' suit, which is being developed at MIT called the Bio Suit, it's a mechanical counterpressure suit, but because it's using state-of-the-art materials, you can have a suit where it kind of expands so you can get into it, because they're very hard to get into. And then when you're ready for the pressure exposure, it can go into its second state, transition to this kind of constrictive suit. Mm-hmm. I've done suit tests with the mechanical pressure suit and with just the glove. And they give you much more flexibility. Anytime you don't have a seal, though, it gives you like a little hickey. And I remember around my hair follicles, I had little petechiae mm-hmm. from the vacuum exposure. So there are some super novel ideas coming out there, and Davis' suit, I'm just super excited to see that. Hopefully it'll come out and it'll be much more easy to use. If you look at the suits now, in fact, there's a new company that just tested its suit, Final Frontier Design, and you kind of look like a caterpillar inchworm. You're all puffed up, and suits when they pressurize are really a problem. There was a team that flew a high-altitude glider called Perlin, and that was Steve Fawcett and Einar Eversole, and they wore the David Clark suit, which is the same suit they used in the U-2. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that they're up at, 55,000 feet, the suit's starting to inflate because it starts inflating over 35,000 feet. And the problem is that Einar couldn't use the control stick because the suit and everything basically just filled up the glider cockpit.
Right.
And so they've come up with a new one now, which just doesn't use a suit, but they're always worried about that fact. But the problem is that suits always inflate. And when they do, they reduce mobility. The other idea is to use a one atmosphere suit, which is totally gimbaled and doesn't change volume, and that's like the Newt suit or the Jim suit.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some new suit designs that are based on that concept.
So, John, you've discussed ways to transition the world of the lab into useful projects, just like what you've been talking about pretty much all the way through STEM Talk. The question you said is, how do you get a deliverable from research? You then said that that's your utility, and that's what you bring to the table, which I think we all agree on, but just kind of commentary there and maybe any kind of comments from your side of things.
Well, this is an area that's near and dear to my heart. Gosh, it would be insulting to scientists to say that I'm a scientist. So even though I'm a senior scientist here at IHMC, I think the emphasis is on senior or senior. Anyway, so here's the deal, and we always have to remember this in research. Research is just the first phase. It's research, development, test, evaluation, and then operational integration.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I look at it is I'm like the BASF. I don't make the suit. I make it better. And when I was at NASA and in the Navy, part of my job, even though I did research, as much as that was to the chagrin of others, is my real thing was to make sure that the end user just loved it.
Yeah.
Not only just loved it, they wanted it before anything else. That's when you know you've got a good product, is that it's something that's, you know, the killer app, the one, you know, one of a kind thing that everybody wants to have.
Yeah. And you're coming in from this with this vast operational experience too. So you get that and you know what it's like to be on the end user side of things. So I can appreciate that. That's why I got into research actually, was to try to feed back to the end users that I know. So it's the same thing. So John, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, William Fife was a key mentor of yours. And now you work with his daughter, who we actually know very well because she's also heavily involved in the diving community and trained at Duke. I know that your mentorship is an important priority of yours, and at this stage of your career, you feel that it's payback time. So you focus a large amount of your time on mentoring students and interns and other trainees. Talk a little bit about this mentoring process, and what advice would you give to someone wanting to go into aerospace medicine or research?
Well, my first and foremost advice is always follow your dream.
Mm.
Don't do this because your parents think that that's what you should do, or that because you think that's what you're going to make a lot of money at. It's got to be a passion and a dream. And I think that we all share here this unbridled passion for doing what we do and being with the team we love to do. So I do mentor a lot of students, and I don't necessarily do it just based on what university or academic institution they're affiliated with. I send out information if somebody has a question about it. I have websites, links, file references. I have a huge Dropbox file on all kinds of different things. So people can say, hey, I'm really interested in this. This is how I get started. And to the degree I can help them, you know, on an individual basis, I will. But most importantly, it's to build the contact networks that they need so that they can follow their dream. And that's the most important thing in life. I have three guiding principles: courage, competence, and commitment.
That's good.
And by following those, you know, your dreams will come true.
I love it. I'm putting that up in my office. And I understand that you like to think that one of your students will someday walk on Mars.
I'm sure of it. I don't usually get to the high school mentoring because, you know, I'm in a medical school and here, you know, so it's mostly PhD or postdocs or MD or, you know, residency trained folks. But I had a high school student and he wanted to do a rotation. So I said, okay, fine. You know, we'll figure a way to do it. And he'd actually been to a talk. I was given a talk on commercial spaceflight at the World Affairs Council in Houston. It was kind of hey, here's what we're doing in commercial space. And he came up afterwards and, you know, and asked me about this. And I said, sure, we'll figure out a way to do it. And, you know, he's in high school, he's going to go to college and he's going to go to medical school and he'll probably go where I train or where I was teaching at the time. And I'm absolutely sure he'll walk on Mars someday. Absolutely sure about it.
Fantastic.
So following up on space exploration, NASA's been formulating plans for a crew-tended cislunar space station concept known as the Deep Space Gateway. This station could be used as a staging ground for robotic and crewed lunar surface missions as well as for travel to Mars. Can you talk a little bit more about the Deep Space Gateway?
Well, you know, periodically NASA goes through its mission, design reference missions, and says, here's our targeted goal. I think first and foremost, they need to have a consistent, non-politicized funding status that doesn't come and go with every, you know, administrative cycle.
Yeah, good luck with that.
I know it is. And I was on the Constellation Standing Review Board, and I saw how, you know, things, you know, went. Then the new guy comes in and dismantles it. So the thing is, the Deep Space Gateway is a very viable process. It's actually part of a program. The Deep Space Gateway is the part that's going to use existing technologies that are currently actually available, put them together, and then go beyond low Earth orbit, which is something we need to get experience with. We need to get more deep space exposure. We need to see what the radiation environment's like, what the habitability and life support systems are going to do, and how do we get along and thrive in a small Winnebago for 6 to 8 months. I do a talk, and I talk about some of the things where crew talked about killing the other guy, mm-hmm. cosmonaut mm-hmm. in particular, or a crew that were so depressed that they were going to kill themselves. There's some serious behavioral things we need to kind of get a handle with, and we need to do it in the real world. Low Earth orbit, the ISS, has been a marvelous test bed. It is an analog for deep space. We work out some of the kinks. Now we're ready to go do Deep Space Gateway. I think it's a great program. Now, the idea is that they're going to go, they're going to take an ISS module for crew, and they're going to put it out further than low Earth orbit, which is, about 250 miles where we are now. And then they're going to ferry crew back and forth. They're going to get some experience in deep space. They're going to learn from it using existing technologies. And then the next phase is the deep space transportation. So here's the deal. To get to low Earth orbit, you need to escape the Earth's gravitational pull. That's about 17,500 miles an hour. That's the what they call escape velocity. To go to the moon, you need about 25,000. So the difference incrementally is a lot less. Well, that's why a deep space gateway is very valuable, because the energy well that you've got to go there and get your, say for example, build things and get them ready to go, is a lot less. And then to go to Mars, 35. Mm-hmm. So you need an incrementally smaller amount of delta V, the energy of escape velocity, to go to Mars from a lunar post. Now, there's a lot of controversy, even as you can imagine. Well, why are we going back to the moon? Why don't we just go to Mars? Low Earth orbit is Everest Base Camp. And the Deep Space Gateway is, camp 2 and 3.
Right.
You don't go to the Himalayas without going to base camp and without going to camps 1 through 4 and then go to the summit.
Right.
So Deep Space Gateway, cislunar, is a base camp or advanced base camp.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I look at it.
It's
just pure and simple. It's just expeditionary medicine.
Yep. That's a great way of putting it. So we're going to get to, in your spare time, as our listeners have heard, John is very adventurous, so you continue to live an adventurous lifestyle. Tell us about your recent sailing expedition off of the California coast.
Well, this was a bucket list. So imagine, this was our medical team from Red Bull.
Mm-hmm.
It was Andy Pilmanis, who was the senior guy. He was in his 70s, and John Clark in his 60s, and Matt Turney in his 50s, and Alex Garbino in his late 30s, mm-hmm. almost 40s. So Andy, who is a phenomenal guy, he was a big in the saturation diving world and ran the Catalina Hyperbaric Chamber and was involved in all those sat projects out there, and then went to the Air Force.
Nice.
So he's had 40 years in both undersea and altitude, and he lived out in the Channel Islands, which are the islands off the coast of California. And he's going through a bucket list thing, which I think I'm starting to build my list to. And he says, I want to go back to all those places I went when I was, actively sailing. And so we pulled our team together and said, this was a core group of folks that were involved in the Red Bull and the Stratix flights, the two high altitude jump projects. And I'm a pretty experienced sailor and diver, and Andy is a really experienced sailor and diver, and Alex is a really experienced sailor and diver, and one guy hadn't done much either, but was very interested. So we all paired up, and to me, I'll tell you what's a great experience. If you want to emulate space, go do it on a sailboat.
Mm-hmm.
You got, it's small volumes. You got to work together as a team. It's dangerous. It can kill you. It's hard. There's some scary moments, but man, at the end of that, it's like the awesomest experience ever.
Mm-hmm.
What I've realized is, there's that we do not function as isolated entities. And what I loved about with the Marine Corps, with my lab experience, with NASA, with commercial space and all that is to find the tribe. A group is like a sports fan club, and a team is like a a soccer team, but a tribe is where your fundamental survival is dependent on each other. Mm-hmm. And when you get to that point, when you go on to a sailing trip off the Channel Islands and you're having to fight bad weather and you're having to navigate and find anchorages and then do diving and all that, there's kind of like a little mini shuttle mission, mm-hmm. you know? And I thought, man, this is the tribe. We love each other,
yeah.
you know? And you're sharing stories, you're laughing, you're crying. You know, that is the most unbelievable experience in the world. And we sailed every day. We'd go to a different anchorage and we'd anchor out. We'd go and explore some of these islands like San Miguel. Man, there's nobody on there. There was a park ranger and a volunteer, and that was it. And you go to Santa Cruz, or we did Santa Cruz, Santa Rosa, Santa Catalina. And every day it was something different, and we're already planning our next trip. Mm-hmm. In fact, we were talking about it at a bar a couple nights ago, you know, like, hey, we're going to go do a trip from Pensacola to Key West, you know.
Sailing, yep.
We got to find our tribe.
Yep.
IHMC is a great tribe.
Absolutely. Yeah,
a collection of tribes.
Yep.
Also, this past July, you did the Knowles Executive Leadership Expedition trip in the aptly named Wind River Range of Wyoming. Knowles is just a great organization. Roger Smith, our guest on STEM Talk number 51, and his wife, Margaret Creel, were both longtime Knowles instructors. Can you share a little bit about your experience in the Wind River Range?
I love Knowles. I mean, Knowles is National Outdoor Leadership School, and they're based in Lander, Wyoming. And they're about growing environmentally conscious citizens. They have a great program for high school and college students. They're a big part of AmeriCorps. Man, I wish I had known them. I had the Boy Scouts when I was growing up, but I love Knowles. They do also a lot of wilderness medicine and expeditionary training.
Yeah, they publish some great books too about
absolutely. And boy, you talk about a test bed. In fact, most of the time, you know, everybody had to tell their story, you know, kind of, and then even instructors, and everybody got to know each other so well afterwards. But why it was especially important to me was Knowles, it was an amazing opportunity. NASA decided that they wanted to kind of explore how to train the astronaut crews as expeditionary crew members. Expeditionary crew members are basically to grow the tribe so that you fundamentally get each other. You can read each other's minds. And the 107 crew that Laurel was a part of, that they were the first NASA group to go do that. And it was specifically designed to teach them that. And they had come from different backgrounds and different cultures and I wouldn't say they were not gelled, but they were all so different. And most shuttle crews, they only train for 6 months. And then they go to do a mission. And the ISS crews that are trained for 2.5 years, they come back, they're much more like a tribe. But shuttle crews were not like that. But because the Columbia kept getting delayed for a variety of reasons, they said, well, let's go send them on this Knowles thing. It was unbelievable. They came back. It was the tribe. It was so cool.
Yeah.
After Columbia happened, we went out with Knowles instructors, and they said, we're going to take the families out and do Columbia Peak in the Colorado Range. And so I had been wanting to do this Knowles trip forever. And finally, I said, I'm going to do it. And I tried to talk Dawn into going with me.
Yeah. My intent was to go, but we had some other conflicts come up. So,
but you know, the cool
next,
thing is
next year.
I'll do it again. Go do kayak. There's 1,000. I'd spend the rest of my life doing Knowles trips. I'm thinking about how do I do that. It's a great test bed for physiologic monitoring, mm-hmm. for team building, for all those kinds of things. I love Knowles. And mm-hmm. It's cool that to go to the Wind River where they went. And I felt the spirit there. I honestly did. It was kind of eerie.
Yeah.
But I definitely felt it. And, you know, you think, who's got the best leadership training in the world? Yeah, the Navy, the Naval Academy, and NASA. And they now use that as their primary, you know, expeditionary behavior building tool. So I would strongly encourage, and they have scholarships too. Even if you can't afford it, mm-hmm. they'll find a way. That's one of the best leadership citizenship training programs in the whole country.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Well, John, this has been absolutely fantastic chatting with you today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you. It was great, John.
Well, it's just an honor to be involved with you all in the tribe, yeah. The IHMC tribe.
Welcome to the tribe.
STEM Talk.
As expected, John has so many great stories to tell. He has not only witnessed, but been part of so much of aviation and space medicine history. I can't tell you how thrilled I am right now that John is a colleague at IHMC and that we'll be working together on so many projects in the near future.
John is not only one of the most interesting people I know, but he's also one of the finest. He really has served our country admirably. Like you, Don, I am glad to call John a colleague, and it's nice to have him on the team at IHMC.
Can't agree more. If you enjoyed this interview as much as we did, I invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others, so please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.